Bangily bang, it's me, Randy Newman, and I love to sing a song about a podcast.
Actionable, Chris, let's move on.
Bangily bang, on the Emperor Podcast this week, we will interview them on the beaches. We will interview them in hotel rooms. We will interview them in pod booths. And by them, of course, I mean Joe Wright, director of Darkest Hour, and Martin McDonagh, director of Three Billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri. All that and more on the movie podcast that doesn't think Gary Oldman sounds anything like Churchill. He didn't even get the, oh yes, bit right. Just an amateur. An amateur. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the second Empire podcast of 2018. I'll be honest, I need a break. I'm shattered.
You are?
I need a holiday. I need a holiday. I've just had one, I know.
You just had one, yeah.
This year's just been draining. Draining.
It's the 11th of January, Chris.
When's it over?
The 31st of December.
Anyway, this week I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. And before you ask, don't worry, they are both receiving equal pay for this.
I.e. none, yeah.
Yes. I can't comment, though, on what they'll be paid if we have to drag them back in for an expensive re-record. I'm talking, of course, about Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
And James Dyer.
Hello.
We have a question, and this comes from Twitter, and it is from @Tanya_. Now, I'm going to pronounce this knees, but it might be nice, or it might be I'm assuming this is a Dutch surname, so I do not know how to pronounce it. So Tanya, write in if we got it wrong. Right, so Tanya asks, with the fabulous bar scene in The Greatest Showman.
Right.
What are your favourite bar scenes in movies? Now, if you haven't seen The Greatest Showman, there is a bar scene.
It's a sort of romantic scene, isn't it, between Hugh Jackman and Zac Efron?
Yeah, it's almost like they're meet cute, isn't
it? Is,
it?
Yeah, it's but in, yeah, it's their sort of...
Between two straight guys and...
Sure. I just mean there's an energy in the film. Anyway,
yes.
there's an energy at that scene by the end of it because
it is a seduction scene.
It's a seduction scene. Hugh Jackman is trying to woo Zac Efron to
become his business partner.
Dip into his big man purse.
No.
What? And fund Hugh Jackman's big top.
Okay.
That's what I took from it.
Sure.
Right. They're flirting melodically with each other. And then by the end of it, you're thinking, are they going to kiss at the end?
They should have kissed.
It would have maybe deviated from the story of P.T. Barnum. But they were already doing that anyway. So why not?
Sure.
Sure.
Anyway, it's a really fun scene. And it is a good song.
Sure. So Tanya's question is, what are your favourite bar scenes in movies? And I started to even put together like the smallest list, like the things that just popped into my head.
Yeah.
And this is a big old category.
Huge category, yeah.
We could be here for some time.
Raiders of the Lost Ark just popped into my head, actually, and that's probably...
Good shout. The prologue.
Yeah. Mm. No, the... What?
The prologue.
Yeah. Is it the prologue?
Well, I don't know. It depends.
Have you seen Raiders of the Lost Ark?
Yeah, it's been a while. You know, with the burning of the hand and the bar. Yeah.
That's not like the prologue.
Oh,
like,
no, sorry. Yeah, you're right. It's not a prologue. It's the beginning. The prologue is, of course, the idol. Yes, yeah. I know that.
It's early in the film.
It's about 25 minutes in, so I can see how you would confuse it with the beginning of the
movie. Well, I get confused. What can I tell you?
But yeah, it's amazing. It's a great, great, great character introduction for Marion.
Yes.
It's a brilliant way to set up their relationship. It establishes your villain and how villainous he is. It has a little, you know, funny twist in it. It's just great.
Yep. I like that scene. Mm. I like that scene a lot.
Better than the bar in the actual prologue of Temple of Doom.
Oh, no, that's amazing. But is that a bar or is it more of a nightclub?
Oh, it is club. It is Club Obi-Wan.
Yes.
After all.
I'm going to throw a left field choice in here and say the scene in The Guest with the fireball. Remember when he orders the fireball drink, which I can't remember what the spirit is, but it's got cinnamon in it and it's presumably quite hot when thrown in your face.
Oh, yes, that's right. Oh, then he takes out the guys, doesn't he?
Yes.
Yes, that's a very
marvelous.
Good scene. That's a good scene. Anything else?
Well, you know.
Desperado weirdly came to my mind, which
is
the first time in a long time, but... There's a great fight scene in a bar there.
Yes. The musical number where he does Canción del Mariachi. As well.
Yes.
Very good. Very good.
Didn't you once talk a mariachi owl into playing that for us in the office?
I did. And that is, every word of that is literally true. I requested that particular song from a mariachi owl who then, along with her owl colleagues, performed it for me. It was... it's just another normal day in the Empire office.
This was, of course, a jobbing actor in a suit rather than an actual owl.
As I recall, it was some sort of promotional thing for Rango, where for mariachi people. No, actually, it was a mariachi band, and then four dancing owls,
yes,
wasn't it?
Who were dressed as mariachi, yeah, but they obviously hampered by the owl suits.
Were not unable to play the instruments, indeed, yes. But I requested that song from Desperado, and they all just...
They knew
ripped
it.
Into it, yeah, they
it's
did.
Great.
It's good. I mean, I think it's quite a famous song, to be fair. I don't think it's, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good one to have in your repertoire if you are a mariachi.
Yeah.
Anything else? There's loads. I've got loads written down here.
Mos Eisley. Let's chuck out the Star Wars Cantina. That's a bar.
It is a bar.
Yeah.
That's a great scene.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you have the equivalent scene in Attack of the Clones.
Yes,
with,
you do.
Lansley's Bagano.
Want to buy some death sticks?
You don't want to sell me death sticks.
Want to go home and rethink your life?
You wish to go home and rethink your life. Rethink your review.
I want to go home and rethink my review.
Yeah.
I was totally Jedi mind tricked. I was thinking about that again today. Ah, such regret.
Deep regret.
Such regret. Because, you know, Last Jedi is so much about failure and learning from your failures.
Have you?
No. I don't think
no.
I have.
No, you haven't.
No. But the Withnail scene, I think, still stands up, especially because it's set in the 60s, and especially because it is very, very reflective of 60s mindsets. And it has some amazing lines. You know, if you, I have a heart condition. If you hit me, it will be murder. I called your friend a ponce, and now I'm calling you a ponce. It's so good. It's so good. I just go through my list because, my God, Casablanca, Ice Cold and Alex, if you want to
coming
have
up
another
on its,
classic one in there as well.
60th anniversary?
70th? Is it?
Yeah.
Is it?
1958, I believe.
The very end
Wait,
of that film.
Wouldn't that be 70?
Ah, who knows? Yeah. Who knows? Mathematicians, maybe.
Probably.
People with calculators. Who knows?
Jessica Rabbit's introduction at the Ink and Paint Club.
Yeah. That's... Again, a club, though.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. That is a club.
But is there a bar?
Yes.
Right. I mean...
But then there's a bar in Club Obi-Wan, and you just...
But does he go to the bar in Club Obi-Wan?
No, they come to him.
Right. Okay. So I'm saying that...
But they also... But Betty Boop serves him in the Ink and Paint Club, so he doesn't go to the bar there either.
That's right. True. It's table service.
All right. Let's take that aside. That's jettison Who Framed Roger Rabbit. That's gone.
Damn you.
I'm gonna throw in another one. Again, unfortunately titled The Titty Twister from Dusk Till Dawn, because obviously that is basically the second half of the whole movie set in that bar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, after the prologue, you mean?
Yeah, after the prologue, which of course stretches for the first 90 minutes. yes, that one.
Have we not mentioned Gremlins?
Oh, yes, oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. Phoebe Cates serving bar.
Yeah.
Taking pictures.
The flasher gremlin.
Indeed.
Which raises so many questions.
Brilliantly. Yeah, it does.
It's
since
a gremlin.
They're basically without genitals, that's not how they reproduce. So I'm not sure what it was
so
showing off.
What is he flashing?
It's hard to say.
Yeah, well, it's true of many flashers.
Maybe gremlin's tadges are tucked away. Maybe it's a bit of a Buffalo Bill
Please
situation
let us
going on.
Never have this discussion
Perhaps it's,
again.
It's enclosed in a kind of Shape of Water type fashion.
No, again, let's just stop there.
Perhaps a protective sheath.
No.
No?
No.
Okay.
Nuh-uh.
Wow.
So there's Gremlins. That's a great scene. 48 Hours. There's a great scene in that.
Is a phenomenal scene. Almost entirely improvised by Eddie Murphy.
Was it improvised?
Yes. Originally, he was supposed to be going into... it was a black bar. And he was going in to talk to the people in the bar. He was black, and that was the whole thing. That he would speak to them in God only knows what way. That would have been horrendous. But they decided, no, let's make it a redneck bar and just let him do his thing. And I think it made them very nervous. Like they thought it was, they were very concerned about the material, but it became like the standout scene in the film. Like it went down a storm. And it is very, very good. It's in many ways Eddie Murphy is his best, that when he's just completely unfettered, unrestrained. Love it.
That reminds me of the Blues Brothers, mm-hmm. where they go to perform also in a redneck bar.
Yes, they mm-hmm. do.
Where they play both kinds of music, country and western, and yes, they have to improvise somewhat to match their playlist.
They just play Rawhide and Stand By Your Man
over and over again. Exactly.
What's the name of the bar / pub in The Fellowship of the Ring? The Green Dragon. The Green Dragon. Prancing Pony. Oh, I think in the Prancing Pony.
Yeah, the bigger scene is in the Prancing Pony.
Yeah. So there you go. There's that. But it's a pub, not a bar.
Pubs are fine.
Oh, but clubs aren't. You fascist.
Pubs are bars.
If pubs are allowed, then slaughtered lamb, presumably.
Slaughtered lamb.
Yeah, there you go. Pubs.
Yeah.
The Winchester.
The Winchester.
Well, the entire Cornetto trilogy has great scenes set in bars. Mm. I believe there's a couple of pubs in the World's End. I don't know.
One or two. No more than like nine, anyway.
Can you name, off the top of your head, without looking it up, how many of the pubs in the World's End can you name?
The World's End.
There was one with twins. There was one with something with two in it.
You've got a T-shirt with them all on.
I do.
And
do.
I can't remember any of them.
Oh, God. This is like...
One with a dog. It related to things that happened.
Dog.
It related to things that happened in the film. I'm vaguely remembering.
Oh, Jesus. There's the... God.
Uh-huh.
Don't listen to this, Edgar Wright. That's for sure. There's the World's End.
That's brilliant.
Thank you, Chris. Well done.
There's the mermaid.
Right.
There's the two-headed dog.
See? Two-headed dog. Okay.
There's the famous cock. Because he walks in and he gets barred.
Right.
Right. There's the... That's four.
It's amazing. Right. Amazing.
We're doing well. All right. So then there's eight others.
Great.
Is the House of Blue Leaves technically a bar?
No.
Or is it like a tea house?
It's a tea house.
Not accepting that.
Fine.
Sorry.
Out it goes.
We're desperately trying to remember the rest of the pubs. I used to know them off by heart. Mm. Such a shame. Is this because my memory's going now?
Yes.
Heather, is it going?
No. Calvin, you're fine.
Calvin! Jesus. Top improv going on here. So we've got an American Werewolf in London. That's an amazing scene. With Nell, Casablanca, Ice Cold Alex. There's just a list I'd written down. The Shining. It's a great scene in the bar. The Shining with Lloyd, the imaginary barman. Mm-hmm. Three Amigos. It's great because I was thinking Western saloons. There's always great scenes in Westerns. And the one that really popped into my head was My Little Buttercup. When the Three Amigos...
has the sweetest smile.
When they go to this bar and they're mistaken for ice cold killers and everyone's terrified of them. And then they perform the most dainty little musical number you've ever heard.
It's a lovely song, that.
It's such a lovely song. And one of my favourite moments in that is they see the piano and Chevy Chase, they go, they said to Chevy, who's Chevy Chase playing that one? My God, my mind.
There's Dusty Rhodes, Ned Niederlander.
He's Lucky Day, isn't he?
Lucky Day.
Chevy's Lucky Day. And Martin Short is Ned Niederlander and Steve Martin's Dusty Rhodes. People are going to write in and tell us that's wrong. If you're going to do so, please tell us the other eight pubs in the World's End as well. That'd be great. And it goes, oh, there's a piano over there, Lucky. And he's going, oh, I don't know how to play that thing. And he's already walking over to it. It's a beautiful little touch. I love it. Speaking of great comedies with bars, I have to mention Top Secret. Because not only is there a bar fight in Top Secret, it is set underwater.
Underwater.
It's an amazing sequence.
It's a full saloon bar underwater. For no reason.
You know this film, Jimbo?
I have never seen Top Secret.
What?
I have genuinely... It's not really my sense of humour.
Nothing is your sense of humour.
Aaron Sorkin did a pass on it. You should give it a go.
I will absolutely get it out immediately.
It's a four-star masterpiece. Yeah. There's an amazing sequence where Nick Rivers, our hero, played by Val Kilmer, is battling Nigel, a.k.a. the Torch, and they fall, they're fighting on this thing in a very silent movie parody way, and they fall into a river, and they continue their fight underwater, and then slowly but surely, they begin to encounter an underwater saloon that's just there for no reason, complete with a bartender who smashes the torch over the head with a bottle, people playing poker at a table...
Which obviously gets overturned. The cards float everywhere, and he has to stride out through the swinging doors at the end.
Well,
even though there's no ceiling,
a chandelier. That
it does sound hilarious.
Oh come on, you old curmudgeon! You're ridiculous. And the last two had written down here: Goodfellas, because Billy Bats at the beginning gets killed gets stabbed at least in the in the bar. Or punched and kicked and shoved, maybe not stabbed. And then Glorious Bastards is that great scene in the bar as well with Michael Fassbender. And
yeah. Failing to order drinks the right way.
Uh-oh. Is that a real thing or is that one of those Quentin Tarantino affectations?
I assume it's a real thing. I don't know. If you're German, please tell us how you count to three on your fingers.
There's a lot of stuff for people to remember to write in about from this segment. But okay, so if you are German and you know the correct way to order drinks in Germany... Write in and tell us if Quentin Tarantino got that right. Write in with the other eight names of the pubs in the World's End. I will endeavour to remember those during the course of the podcast. And what was the other one?
I think that was it, wasn't it?
That was one other one, but okay. Who knows? Who knows? Anyway.
Oh, if we're wrong about Dusty Roads and Lucky Day.
Which we probably are. So if you want to have your question read out in the Empire Podcast, then let's face it, why wouldn't you? You can do so via a number of methods. We're on Twitter as @EmpireMagazine. You can use the hashtag EmpirePodcast. We're on Facebook as Empire Magazine, and you can email us as well at podcast@empireonline.com.
Correct.
That's right. Thank you. Forgot there for a second. And hey, also, if you want to ask us questions in the flesh, you can do so at our 300th episode, which is being recorded live on Valentine's Day, February 14th, in case you don't know when that is.
Apparently, it's also Ash Wednesday this year. So if you're, you know, planning to on stuff for Lent, that's the day to start.
Oh, amazing. So we'll get Bruce Campbell along to that as well. So anyway, we're doing a live show at the King's Place on February 14th. It's going to be amazing. We're going to have some star guests. It's going to be fun, lots of fun. Doing the usual stuff, and tickets are on sale right now, just £12.50 for a ticket at King's Place. www. Someone wrote in and said, I only do www.
Oh,
so I'm going to be very, very clear. www.kingsplace.co.uk is the address if you want to get that right. And while we're doing some housekeeping, I might as well tell you that the Last Jedi spoiler special is happening. It has been recorded. Just have to edit the thing. It'll be up on Monday, January 15th. So just in time for the movie's airplane release. And then our Blade Runner 2049 spoiler special will be out on February 5th to tie in with the DVD and Blu-ray release.
Yeah,
of
we should probably do that one.
We should record that at some point.
Man, These are exciting times.
They're a great time to be alive. And you know what? It's an even better time to be alive if you like Joe Wright, who is our first guest this week.
Seamless segue. Wow.
Yeah, amazing. He is the director, of course, of Atonement, Pride and Prejudice, Hannah, Anna Karenina. Had a slight misstep, I think it's fair to say. You all right there, Helen? Dribbling water down yourself?
Yeah, it was overfull.
Okay. He had a slight misstep, I think it's fair to say, with his last film, Pan, which was...
Panned?
That's the word I was looking for. Thank you. Only I can think of the right word. Thank God you're here, Jimbo. Needless to say, though, he's had the last laugh and he's bounced back, just like Alan Partridge, with Darkest Hour, a tale of how Winston Churchill tackled the thorny issue of what to do with Dunkirk. It'll probably bag Gary Oldman the Best Actor Oscar, and we sent Nick Desemlian for It Is He along to talk to Joe Wright when he came into town just before Christmas. So do please enjoy.
We are delighted to be joined by Joe Wright on the Empire Podcast. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you.
End of a long day.
Yes, it has been a lot of talking today.
You haven't made any speeches, though.
No. Well, yeah, kind of. Yeah, maybe.
People waving handkerchiefs around.
No, none of that.
Yeah.
You get to the end of a day of press and you go, what have I talked about? What am I talking about?
We're talking about talking. I mean, the movie is a very talky one by its nature. It's lots of talking about men in rooms, talking about politics and military strategy. Was that a daunting thing? Was that
much so. And that was the big challenge of the job, really, was to try and find a way of making a movie that it was inherently, you know, people talking in rooms, cinematic and dramatic and exciting for film audiences.
Did you go back and look at other films that are
a little bit
that kind of structure? Anything in particular?
I looked at 12 Angry Men, which is 12 men in one in one room, and I looked at a lot of Hitchcock's movies. You know, I looked at those kind of early Hollywood movies. The way he was so specific about how he shot stuff. I looked at those. I looked at Downfall as well, which I admired greatly. But then I kind of threw all of that away. You know, you have to just, once you've looked at that stuff, you then have to kind of forget about it and just find your own way through it.
Well, there's some fantastic camera work. I think the film starts with this amazing shot going down into the house with everyone talking and moving around, and it's very kind of kinetic.
Yeah, it's I always like thinking up the first shot of a film, you know, and how it might express the film in its entirety, and it was exciting to start with a scene of that kind of scale and energy.
And there's a fantastic build-up to introducing Churchill. obviously Gary, you can't imagine anyone else doing it in this film now, but when you signed on, was Gary part of it at that point? Or
no, he wasn't. I was very intrigued by the script. I liked the script very much. It made me laugh and it made me cry and it made me think. And I thought it was very entertaining. But I wondered whether I'd pay money to go and see a film about Winston Churchill, you know. And then I thought of Gary, and I thought I'd definitely pay money to go and see Gary play Winston Churchill. He's an actor who has been a bit of a hero of mine since I was very young. And I think he's he's the greatest actor on the planet as far as I'm concerned. So the opportunity to work with him was something that I was, desperate to have.
And this was your first time meeting him for this project?
I met him actually once before, about 25 years ago. He made a film called Nil by Mouth, as you know, that he directed. And a mate of mine, Kathy Burke, was in the film. She was like a mentor to me when I was young. So she took me to a screening of the film. And I remember it was just me and Kathy in the cinema. And then Gary and someone else sat way back behind us. And I remember being completely blown away by the film. It's an incredible piece of work. And then afterwards, the light came up and Kathy introduced me to Gary and said, this is Joe. He's going to be a film director and he's going to direct you in a movie one day. And I was like, yeah, right. Hello, Mr. Oldman. Thanks very much. Lovely to meet you. That's my Kevin Perry impersonation. And lo and behold, so it came to pass. Kathy the witch.
The prophet. Yeah. Did you remind Gary of that?
Yeah, I did. I reminded him of it the first time we ever met, actually. It was my ace card, you know.
And is it true? I read that meeting, you guys were vaping together. Is that true?
Why that got picked up, I don't know.
I just imagine you two in a cloud of smoke, which is quite apt for this project, I guess.
For this project, yeah, maybe.
And I imagine the two of you clicked very quickly and...
Yeah, it was, I just love Gary, and he's a very conscientious human being and he's very gentle and thoughtful he's not kind of a bullshitter, nor does he like to be bullshitted, bullshat. And we got on really well. We're both from London and we both share some love of British theatre and film and David Bowie and,
Of course, yeah. I think that they were friends.
They were very good friends,
yeah. We talked about it on this podcast, actually.
Yeah, did he tell you that they used to speak on the phone every Sunday?
I think he mentioned that, yeah.
I said to him, what did you talk about? He said, well, England, mostly. I just like the idea of Gary Oldman and David Bowie talking about Victoria Sponge Cake and the likes.
I would love to listen to those conversations. Do you have a favourite Gary performance?
That's a really tough one. That's a really tough one. I loved The Firm. I love Alan Clark as a director. And I thought Gary was incredible in that. That completely blew my mind. There's a scene when he goes back to his parents' house flat and he goes into his childhood bedroom and gets out a cosh and starts beating a pillow. And I remember just looking at that going, that's amazing. That's amazing acting, that is. And
It must have been astonishing watching delivering these speeches there. Were you able to kind of enjoy that at the time, or were you just too busy being a director and stressing out about various things?
I enjoy directing, I love it. It's my favourite thing in the world to be on set making a movie, I couldn't wish for anything better. So to be there doing that, something I love, be realizing those moments with Gary playing his role so beautifully, was wrapped up in a great big bow of celluloid, except we shot it digitally.
Right. And you have these lovely shots throughout the film of at least a few of them of Churchill kind of surrounded by darkness, which I really liked. Kind of a lot of the screen was black at certain points. I don't know if I just have whether that was in your mind, but there is the scene where he's in the lift and it's all dark around him. I was wondering if that was a deliberate.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I wanted to, you know, one of the issues with making the film is that it's set in May 1940, and yet we were shooting it in December and January, so we couldn't go outside and do exteriors. And I wanted to get some wide shots. I wanted to get some sense of scale. And yet we were shooting these very small underground rooms. And so the idea of coming outside of the room and seeing the room as a box appealed also poetically to me in terms of Winston's isolation and claustrophobia at the time. And so it was all of those kind of elements wrapped up together.
Are you now a master at shooting cigar smoke? Is there anything?
I'm not a master at anything. I don't know. There was a lot of cigar smoke on this project. And what was really funny is, like, a lot of the locations we shot in said, you know, no smoking on set. And then we said, well, listen, it's Winston Churchill. You can't have Winston Churchill without smoking a cigar. And they all went, all right then. And so Winston Churchill is allowed to smoke cigars in some of the most precious places.
I think you can make an exception for him.
I reckon so.
You introduce him having a fry-up, which is perfect. Yeah. How much did you know about Churchill going in? Are you a bit of a history buff? I'm assuming you are to an extent.
No, I'm not really. I mean, I love history. I find it endlessly fascinating how other people have lived throughout, you know, history. But it wasn't, you know, Churchill wasn't necessarily a kind of hero of mine to begin with. I'd never imagined myself making a Churchill movie. But when I read the script, I discovered a character that was this funny man who had this kind of odd, difficult personality, and then was thrown into this position of vast responsibility and tried really hard to do the right thing. And at a certain point had a huge crisis of confidence, of self-doubt, and then overcame that doubt or in fact maybe managed to use that doubt and turn it to something positive. And it was really just about that. His name could have been something else, you know.
It's kind of a psychological study of this guy under incredible pressure.
Exactly.
But you obviously tackled Dunkirk in Atonement from a very different kind of perspective.
It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah, it's weird. You've kind of come back to it. What are your memories of doing that? Because that's obviously a very celebrated sequence from a film. The very, I think, 5 minutes long?
Yeah, something like that. I don't know. My memory of that day is a bit of a blur because it was so adrenalized. I must have walked that beach 100 times that day. It was one of those days that when I look back through the course of my short time, I will remember that day and think that was a beautiful day, you know. What I remember of that day is the men on the beach, the residents of Redcar, where we shot that scene, who were, you know, just normal blokes from you know, worked in the steelworks or whatever, you know, and their commitment and passion and generosity making that shot work. That shot only is works because of those men who were really beautiful, you know. I remember saying to them, listen, we're making a scene about Dunkirk, and I reckon we can honour our grandfathers and our great-grandfathers with this, but I want you to really perform them as they were. I want you to imagine that you're supporters of a football team on an away game and you've just lost, right? And you're all going to behave differently. And some of you are going to get drunk and have a fight, and others are going to start praying or singing hymns, and others are going to get kind of practical and start thinking about how they can build a boat to get home and so on. And there was a lot of humanity on that beach that day, and I find that's what I found most moving about it.
Was that something you, as soon as you read the script, you were like,
no, not at all. It was originally, that scene was originally written as a montage, right? Very detailed montage. And I worked out that it would probably require about 40 setups, 40 different shots to achieve that montage. And I usually get about like between 11 and 14 setups a day. And to shoot that montage, I only had one day. I could afford one day on the beach with 1,000 extras, and that's all I had, which sounds like a lot, but actually then one added the complication that the tide was going to come in and go out, so there'd be no continuity. In fact, the tide was going to wash away our set. So really it was a matter of necessity to create that. And I only figured that out a few weeks before shooting it, that I was going to need to do it as a single Steadicam shot. And it was a big kind of, you know, it was a final push. It was right towards the end of the shoot, and it was a big challenge to myself and the crew, you know.
Yeah, oh, it's an amazing shot. I wanted to ask you about Black Mirror, because that's kind of an really interesting credit on your page. How did you get involved in that?
I was, you know, I'd been stung by the reception to Pan, and I wasn't sure how I'd get back on the horse. And then my casting director, Gina Jay, was casting Black Mirror, and she said, you should do one of these, they're really good. And I read it, and I loved the script. I loved the idea of the script. There wasn't even a script at that stage. I loved the idea because it's all about, you know, outside validation, which was something I was battling with after Pan.
It's about star ratings as well, yeah, which is, yeah, I
which
guess,
is even closer, you know. And so I signed up.
I mean, your work has always been received extremely well. Was, yeah, Pan, was that whole experience a bit of a shock? I'm assuming it was.
Yeah, it was difficult, yeah.
Do you kind of look back on that with regret, or are you happy
no,
you did it still?
I don't regret anything, you know. You can't regret anything, really. It was an amazing experience, and I learned a huge amount from it. I mean, I probably learned more from making that film than I have from any other. I learned what I love, which is drama, and I learned what I'm hopefully, touch wood, good at, which is drama. I'm not really, I don't, you know, I guess I'm not much of a children's entertainer.
Which is interesting, because I read that you wanted to be a magician early,
yeah,
on.
But even when I was a magician, I wanted to do adult
serious magic.
Yeah, fine art, magic, you know. Yeah. I mean, I used to busk in Covent Garden.
Really?
I called myself the Great Kazam, and I had a tailcoat, and I used to busk in Covent Garden. I was quite good. I used to make like 30 quid a day busking. And then Ken Livingstone took over the GLC, the Greater London Council, and decided that no one under 16 was allowed to busk, and I was only like 12 at the time.
Really?
And so he took away my audience. I was devastated. I tried after that to get work, you know, being a children's party entertainer, doing magic at children's parties, and I just resented their lack of sophistication. And I couldn't bear it. So, you know, they didn't take my magic seriously enough.
Yeah.
So in the end, I gave up magic and picked up a Super 8 camera.
I love the idea of you as a very moody magician, the, yeah, people not appreciating the, yeah, seriousness of it all. But you, yeah, have that to fall back on.
Yeah.
I had the Paul Daniels magic set when I was young,
I used to love doing tricks. Yeah, yeah.
I think I can only remember how to do one, which involved an ice cube and a string. Do you remember how to do?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What was your kind of signature trick, if you had one?
I really wanted doves. You see, because I actually called myself, I took myself so seriously, I called myself an illusionist rather than a magician, right? And I wanted doves, And my mum wouldn't let me have doves in the house, obviously. So I got some white satin material and I cut out a bird shape and sewed them together and stuffed it with terrylene and then put a little fake, you know, like a felt beak on them and sewed little eyes on them. And then I put a piece of Velcro on my shoulder and a bit of Velcro on the dove. And then I had a piece of string going down my arm so I could pull the string and the dove, this kind of dove, would nod its head and give away the answers to my illusions. And it went down a storm. Yeah,
it's incredible. I think you should keep this up. I think this there's a future in this.
Well, maybe I'll, you know, we'll see.
Bring the faux dove back. And what have you got kind of lined up? Are you taking a break now, or are you going straight into something?
Yeah, I don't know what I'm going to do, to be honest with you. There's a beautiful script by Andrew Bovell, an adaptation of a book called Stoner. So I might do that.
Yeah.
Later next year, but you know, I get through the next, you know, it's getting through the day is tricky at the moment.
Just so much talking.
Yeah, just so much talking.
Talk. Yeah. And you mentioned when you read the Darkest Hour script, you had a very emotional reaction to it.
Yeah.
Is that what you look for? Do you only kind of take something on if you have that kind of reaction?
I have to have a personal connection with the material, and I have to feel like I know a secret about it. It was a really good, you know, it was a really a wise piece of advice was given me when I was trying to decide between doing Birdsong and Atonement. My agent said to me, well, I can't say which you should do, but if there's one that you know a secret about, then that's the one you should do. And immediately I knew which one, because I felt like I knew a secret about Atonement. I knew that I would, you know, succeed or fail, I would do it differently from anyone else. And so it's about kind of feeling like you know a secret about the material.
Can you reveal what the Darkest Hour one was, or do you keep that stuff close to your chest?
Just keep it close.
Forever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Spoken like a true illusionist.
And drop it in the magic circle for that one.
Do you have I'm fascinated by this magic stuff, but do you have a favourite magician?
I really loved Ali Bongo. He was great.
Yeah. Okay. How did you get into it in the first place?
I don't know. I knew a bloke who showed me a coin trick, I think. Sleight of hand. I was really into sleight of hand. I didn't like kind of card tricks and that sort of stuff. It was all about, you know, illusionist.
Yeah. Okay. I'm desperate to see some now.
You'll never see it.
All right. Joe Wright, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
Okay, so that was Joe Wright, and let's now move on seamlessly to this week's movie news, of which there is quite a bit, a lot of it awards-related. Now, normally on this podcast, we would give the Golden Globes short shrift, but this year's ceremony seemed to be pretty relevant.
Oprah 2020!
And pretty significant.
Yeah, so first of all, I mean, everybody wore black, which was a massive change for the men in particular.
Who died?
Justice and equality, Chris.
What? Okay, fair enough.
It was to mark a collective response, basically, to the recent scandals that have rocked Hollywood, the denouncing of sexual predators like Harvey Weinstein, and the Time's Up response that the ladies of Hollywood have launched in order to help all women, not just those who are making films, to kind of stand up to and call out their accusers and hopefully take them to court and stop them. Sorry, their abusers, not their accusers. Hopefully call them out, take them to court and stop them abusing anyone else. So, and they specifically say this is not just about Hollywood. This is about, you know, agricultural workers. This is about office workers. This is about all women.
Everybody.
They've put together a massive legal fund to help them and... I believe that's now open for donations from normal people as well, and that's basically what the Dressed in Black thing was about. Having said that, not a single one of the male winners specifically touched on the subject, which was a bit of a shame. But many of them talked about it on the red carpet and things like that. So there was a little bit of a show of support there as well, and some people wore pins and that kind of thing if they weren't changing their normal tux.
Yeah.
which there was no reason to do because they're all black anyway, for God's sake. So there's a long way to go, but it's a nice start. And Oprah gave a barnstorming speech, which I recommend watching, listening to, reading a transcript of immediately. It is phenomenal stuff.
It's a reminder of
you know, the power of good public speaking and not just nonsense spouted from a tangerine. It's great.
It was an amazing speech from Oprah.
It was.
Absolutely amazing. I mean, I tend not to give the Golden Globes any relevance, but this year it almost demanded to be taken seriously.
It wasn't about the awards, was it? It was more about the movement and the reception to that. So, I mean, they gave out some awards, felt a little bit like a footnote to this.
Yeah, but I also think that this was the year that they were taken seriously. I've always cocked a supreme leader snook at it. But this year, definitely. I mean, it was absolutely everywhere, and it wasn't just because of Oprah. It was, as you say, because of the Time's Up thing.
Yeah.
But Oprah's speech was just absolutely astonishing, and even more so because she didn't seem to have any written down. Rimmer style, she hadn't written anything on her.
Hands. She's done some public speaking in her time.
Once or twice.
Has she?
Yeah, she's
I only know her from movies.
A little bit much that as soon as someone is able to put together a speech, they're suddenly in the running for the presidency. It's a bit like, really? You know, I mean, don't get me wrong, it was a fantastic speech, but I'm not sure. I think it might be a little bit premature to start, you know.
Yeah, wildly so, frankly. But she's certainly more qualified than the current incumbent, and
as are all three of us,
and probably has more soft power than him right now. But
this packet of delicious,
I don't think she will.
Thai chili and lime crisps is more qualified than the current incumbent, but
true, and less orange. Yeah.
But should we talk about the awards themselves as well? Because they were an interesting batch, and I think coupled with the BAFTA nominations this week. I don't know whether the Oscar picture has become a little bit murkier. I thought I knew where everything was going to go, and now I'm not so sure.
I don't think either of them is a good indicator of the Oscars this year, possibly because my current favourite candidate wasn't particularly well served by either, which is I'm still in the sort of get out for the win camp, actually, for the Oscars. I'm not sure why I think that, but I just do. And the BAFTAs obviously largely ignored it. The Golden Globes ditto. And it was an odd spread of awards. I think we all expected Gary Oldman and Frances McDormand to dominate their categories. I think they remain the ones to beat come the Oscars. But I'm not sure that Three Billboards is quite as much of a leading candidate as the Golden Globes suggested.
So it won quite a few at the Golden Globes.
Yeah.
How many nominations at BAFTAs? Shape of Water has 12.
9, maybe, I think, at the BAFTAs.
So 9 for, well, that's
something like that.
Let's just say 9 and go with that. I don't know. It's interesting. I mean, there's been a lot of conversation about how Get Out might actually have a real shot at winning Best Picture or certainly winning something significant at the Oscars. And then BAFTA comes along and ignores it completely. Also ignores The Post. Spielberg's a Post.
Yeah, I mean, both very American stories, though, so maybe they just didn't chime with BAFTA version. And also, The Post, I think, screened very late and hasn't seemed to screen very much, so I wonder if all the voters have seen it in both cases.
I feel like
that might go some way to explaining The Post's sort of underperformance relatively. The other thing is that I think people take Spielberg for granted, and he tends to underperform at the Oscars unless he gives them literally no choice by making Schindler's List. Like, it is genuinely the fact that, you know, Spielberg has won as few Oscars as he has is baffling to me.
Delighted in terms of the BAFTAs, at least, for Paddington 2. It was nominated for Best British Film.
Yes.
And Paul King and Simon Farnaby nominated for Best Screenplay. Brilliant.
Fantastic.
And Hugh Grant for Paddington 2, nominated for Best Supporting Actor, and in my opinion should win, and is absolutely amazing. Not eligible for this year's Oscars, by the way, in case you're wondering.
It didn't come out in the US in time, did it?
Yes, it's not out yet. It'll be out this weekend, I think, in the US, or next weekend, but coming out very, very soon. But very, very happy for that. And very, very happy as well, honestly. I love Guillermo del Toro to bits, and I'm delighted that he won Best Director at the Golden Globes for The Shape of Water. I'd be very intrigued to see if he now follows suit with the Oscars.
Shame that Greta Gerwig didn't get a nod in either the Globes or the BAFTAs for Best Director, actually.
I haven't seen Lady Bird yet, but I hear very, very
fabulous,
good things.
Fabulous, yeah.
Mm. Who would drop out for Greta Gerwig or for Jordan Peele?
Ridley Scott, maybe?
Was Ridley Scott nominated at the Golden Globes?
Yeah, I believe so.
Mm. Okay. But I will say just one last thing on the subject of the BAFTAs and Hugh Grant and Paddington 2, his tweet reaction, because everyone, pretty much everyone issues statements going, I'm incredibly humbled by this, this wonderful honour. Oh my God, thank you so much. And Hugh Grant tweeted, and he appeared to be possessed by the spirit of Phoenix Buchanan. His tweet is as follows. BAFTA, my darlings, cravat clutch. Gasp, most humble thanks. A solitary tear.
Oh, bravo. Give this man a BAFTA.
How can you not win? He's got to win.
I've never seen as much delight about a single nomination as I saw for his.
I did love him in that film.
He's phenomenal.
So good.
He's up against Sam Rockwell, Rudy Harrelson, Christopher Plummer, and Willem Dafoe in that category. Best actor at the BAFTAs is a tough category. As is this one, best actor in the leading role, Daniel Day-Lewis, Timothy Chalamet, which I believe is how you pronounce his name. And again, please write in if I've got that wrong.
Not Chalamet.
No, I've heard pronounced Chalamet.
Okay.
But, you know, who knows?
Sure.
Okay.
It doesn't sound right to me. No. I always pronounce it Chalamet, but then someone... Maybe I dreamt it. Mm-hmm. Should I do it again?
Nah, don't worry.
Timothy
about it.
Chalamet. I'm going to go with Chalamet because it feels better, doesn't
he's
it?
He's got an accent on the E.
He does. He does. The accent makes it... It can't be Chalamet.
Chalamet. Daniel Kaluuya for Get Out, Gary Oldman for Darkest Hour, and of course, Jamie Bell for Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool.
That category, it's weird because Daniel Day-Lewis is in it and he isn't the front runner. That is bizarre. Have we ever had that before? Crazy.
That is interesting.
Mm.
The front runner, of course, being Gary Oldman.
Gary Oldman, followed by Jamie Bell, of course.
Of course. Not Timothy Chalamet. Anyway. Best film, Shape of Water, Darkest Hour, Dunkirk, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, Call Me By Your Name. Best actress in the leading role, Annette Bening for Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool, Sally Hawkins for The Shape of Water, Frances McDormand for Three Billboards, Margot Robbie for I, Tonya, and Saoirse Ronan for Lady Bird. Now, Saoirse Ronan won at the Golden Globes as well, which is intriguing because I've seen a lot of Margot Robbie frontrunner stuff. Some prognosticators saying that she's probably going to take it, but I think that's actually quite wide open.
I think McDormand's the one to beat. Actually,
she's astonishing at Three Billboards, by the way. Best British film, Death of Stalin, Darkest Hour, Three Billboards. I guess British producers, Lady Macbeth, God's Own Country, and Paddington 2.
That's a phenomenal list, though.
It is a good list. Best actress in a supporting role, Leslie Manville, Alison Janney, Laurie Metcalf, Kristin Scott Thomas, and Octavia Spencer for The Shape of Water.
Also an embarrassment of Richards.
Indeed. Indeed it is.
Manville might take that one. I
thought
really
Alison Janney was the favourite for that.
Oh, Alison Janney is, I think. She's phenomenal in I, Tonya, and indeed in everything she has ever done in her entire life.
Well, her work for Aaron Sorkin is particularly
impressive. And, I mean, her performance as Shopper in Miracle on 34th Street is absolutely brilliant. I'm not even kidding. But I would actually genuinely like to see it go to Leslie Manville because I think she's great in Phantom Threat.
Do you know who I think has dropped out of the Oscar race? And I think it's a real shame. And it's not just the film. It's not just the actress, but the film. Holly Hunter and The Big Sick seems to have dropped out almost entirely. And when
maybe
I saw that film...
Maybe a screenplay nod,
Probably will get a screenplay nod. But I would have thought, when I first saw that film... I thought, okay, here's someone who's going to get... She's great. And Ray Romano is great in that film as well. In fact, they're all great. We haven't watched it again. Kumail Nanjiani is fantastic. I'm a little surprised his name hasn't been in the conversation a little bit more because, yes, he's playing himself, but he does some pretty heavy lifting in that film. But Holly Hunter's great. But this year does seem to be the year best supporting actress of the sharp-tongued mother. And so maybe she was slightly beaten out by the likes of Alison Janney and... Laurie Metcalf, and who knows. Anyway, it's an interesting year, and I'll be very, very intrigued to see how it all pans out. And the Oscar nominations are out in a couple of weeks, right?
Yeah.
A couple of weeks' time? Okay. So let's talk about all that when it happens. Right, what else have we got to talk about? Oh, we should mention that there's another award ceremony coming up.
The Empire Awards?
The Empire Awards.
Yes,
you're absolutely right. And it's the one that they all want to go to, and it's the one that they all want to win. And it's the only one I think can actually be legitimately used as a murder weapon.
It is very weighty,
really?
Surprisingly so.
I feel like you could do some damage with an Oscar.
Well, depends what you do with it, but you could definitely use this as a bludgeoning tool. Jimbo, how can people vote? Where can they vote? And there's a whole ton of categories this year, and some people have been getting in touch with me, and don't worry, you don't have to vote in every single category. If you don't have an opinion on best costume design or best short film, you don't have to fill those bits in. But where can they do this?
They can vote at www. Or just www. No, that won't work. www.empireonline.com/awards2018.
There we go. And when's the deadline?
A good question. I don't know the answer. Hold on.
If you know the answer to the question, when the deadline for the voting...
Can you please write in? Yeah, I will check for you. Hold on.
Please do write in. So what else is happening? A Black Widow movie, maybe.
A Black Widow movie! Hooray!
Friday, the 19th of January.
Wow, that was quick. Marvel move fast, don't they?
That's the deadline.
Oh, right, okay.
Yes.
I thought it was like coming out next week.
That makes a bit more sense.
Yeah, Kevin Feige realised there was a month this year where there wasn't a Marvel movie, and he moved swiftly to fill the gap.
We believe he could do it, don't we?
He probably could.
Yeah.
So this is a Black Widow movie that for years they've said, oh, it won't happen. And you know what? I think this is all down to my tweet a few years ago. I tweeted, would you watch a Black Widow movie? And several hundred people said yes.
Well, that is money in the bank. That's like £1,000 in the bank right there.
Marvel must have looked at it and gone,
four.
Start the ball rolling.
Yes. In several years from now.
I want an executive producer credit, you know, and a check.
Right.
That's what I want. But anyway, yes, tell me more about it.
Well, the big news is that a writer has been hired in the shape of Jack Schaefer, and she wrote the sci-fi indie movie Timer in 2009, if you remember that, has written an alien invasion comedy called The Shower recently, which is apparently in development, but Anne Hathaway is linked to that one, and she liked her so much that she had her write a Dirty Rotten Scoundrels remake, which is called Nasty Women, which I like the sound of. That's coming out this year. She also apparently worked on the script for Olaf's Frozen Adventure, but, you know, let's not watch for that.
Excuse me, there will be no dissing of Olaf's Frozen Adventure, which I watched over Christmas and thought was quite delightful.
So, yeah, so she's obviously quite a hot property right now. She's got all that stuff in development. The work on Olaf in particular means she's already worked with Disney. She's got a little bit of form for the mother studio, if you will. But it's at least taking shape. We don't know when we're going to see it.
Or how it fits into stuff.
Or how it fits in. But presumably, Feige has a plan.
See, the word that I've seen... Indeed.
Sure.
The word that I've seen in relation to this today and the stories is standalone, which intrigues me. And the timing of it intrigues me as well, because we imagine that Black Widow, Natasha Romanoff, played by Scarlett Johansson, of course, will be crucial to the events of Avengers 3 and 4.
Right.
Whether she makes it out... of the events of Avengers 3 and 4.
We don't know about any of them.
Yeah. So, but assuming she does,
sure,
then they're okay. Assuming she doesn't, what does this mean? Does this mean it's a standalone prequel? And when are they going to drop it in? Could you conceivably make a Black Widow, say it was like a John Wick thing, like a really down and dirty, no real trappings of superheroism, no real CG stuff, just a down and dirty spy movie.
Boom.
Featuring Scarlett Johansson kicking the shit out of a whole load of blokes.
Yeah, I mean, it worked in Lucy.
Could you do that and have it in cinemas this year?
What?
Could you do that and have it in cinemas for next year? Certainly,
for next year.
Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it? There's been a lot of set photos from Avengers this week, which I recommend people avoid in case of spoilers.
Yeah. I have a theory about things.
I think
those set visits, the pictures are...
They're backing it up, aren't they, Chris?
I think they are.
We'll say no more about that.
Because we should talk about...
Well, speaking of Captain America with a beard, obviously brings me to Snowpiercer. Look, we're always speaking about Captain America with a beard, aren't we? I feel like.
And then I always say, but enough
like
about Sharon Carter.
Hey!
On we go.
Snowpiercer was Bong Joon-ho's phenomenal 2013 train sci-fi thriller, which didn't even get released in the UK.
So no one has seen it.
Well, I have, because I was clever enough to go to the Edinburgh Film Festival at the right time, James.
Well done, you.
Yes, thank you. But it hasn't been released in the UK because the universe hates us, and that's why Brexit happened. And but there is hope, because a TV series based on it has been picked up by the US cable channel TNT. If that does well, then we can hope that maybe somebody will show us the damn movie already.
I'm right in saying that Chris Evans won't be in it, but the beard will be making an appearance.
I really hope the beard will be there. The film's cast was extremely expensive and high profile. You had Chris Evans, Octavia Spencer, John Hurt, the late great John Hurt, and of course Tilda Swinton. That's obviously a little bit difficult to line those people up. So they are going for Devi Diggs, my beloved Devi Diggs of Hamilton. Jennifer Connelly is lined up for it. Presumably, one might guess in a, something like the Tilda Swinton role, unless they twist everything. But the concept is the same. So the world has become a frozen wasteland after somebody tried to fix global warming and went a little bit too far in the other direction. And the last humans on the planet are circling the globe in this massive, perpetually moving train, which is the only thing keeping them alive. That movement is the only thing that kind of...
It's a train journey that never ends.
A train journey that never ends.
A lot like Southern Rail.
Very much like Southern Rail, except that the whole of humanity is held captive.
So a lot like Southern Rail.
Yes. With class divides and everything. So writer is Josh Friedman, and Scott Derrickson is apparently handling the pilot, which is exciting.
He is. He's talked, the pilot's been shot.
Yeah.
He's talked about it many, many times on the old Twitter machine. I'm intrigued. And I'm also intrigued, the last thing we'll talk about this week in terms of news, that Millie Bobby Brown, who of course plays 11 in Stranger Things, we all know that, we've all seen it, she is going to star in a new movie, and they've already said the word franchise. Jesus Christ,
don't
guys.
Say franchise.
Walk before you can run. She's going to star as Sherlock Holmes' teenage sister, Enola Holmes, based on the Enola Holmes mysteries by author Nancy Springer. And it's going to be a big old blockbuster coming out maybe 2019, 2020, something like that. But here's the kicker as well. Not only is Millie Bobby Brown going to star, she is going to produce the film as well.
Do you ever feel like an underachiever?
A little bit.
Remind me, she's 14?
It says 13 here. So,
oy.
Yeah. But just imagine taking a meeting with a 13-year-old and having to take their notes.
When I was 13...
That's ageist, Chris.
My only accomplishment was having been fired from a paper round. I'm not even kidding.
I'm pretty sure I had a swimming certificate, so like, I guess I'd have that as an accomplishment.
Yeah. Well, when I was 13, my notes to people would have been, it needs more lightsabers and more superheroes. So I think I've really changed.
Your notes when you were when?
Okay. 33.
Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, fair play to her.
Fair play indeed. And listen, if you can do it, if you can wield the power, it doesn't matter how old you are. Yeah. And like I say, she's clearly very, very smart. She supports Liverpool, so she's clearly got her head screwed on.
Good Lord.
Moving hastily on, did you hear that Stephen Knight is making a science fiction show for Apple, which is quite exciting?
Oh, I didn't hear that.
So Apple is stepping up their game to compete with the likes of Amazon and Netflix. It doesn't have a title, but apparently it's a science fiction series, and this kind of joins their new version of Spielberg's Amazing Stories, and Rondi Moore of Battlestar Galactica fame is doing a sci-fi show for them as well.
Wow.
Now, Knight's show, we literally know nothing about it, except for the fact that Francis Lawrence is aboard to direct at least one episode.
Hmm.
How exciting.
It's just interesting because everyone is throwing their hat into this TV game in a big way. And I'm already, frankly, stressed to death with the amount of TV on my list of shit to watch that I don't have time to watch.
So good.
Please, make stuff slower. Just, you're killing me here.
Well, I don't know, but I'm quite enjoying the weekly shows at the moment because, you know, The Good Place was back this week.
Oh,
and
could I say the new Good Place episode was so well written. That Affleck gag was hilarious.
Oh, yeah. And Star Trek Discovery this week.
Yeah, another... Oh my God.
I really want to spoil it and I'm not going to, but you know, mirror universe. Anyway.
I'm also watching Hard Sun, which I'm really enjoying.
Interesting.
Hard Sun? Yeah. I can't talk about the plot because it just ruins it for everyone, but it's Jim Sturgis and Agnes Dean, well worth watching. And I also watched Britannia.
Have you? I haven't seen that yet and I was on set.
Well, I have reviewed it in the next issue and I shan't spoil that for you.
Gosh, that's not ominous at all.
I watched two episodes last night of Law & Order SVU.
Ugh.
And what? Harry Hamlin was in it, all right, and he only had a cameo role in one episode. But the minute I saw him, I turned to my drinking game buddy, wife, and said, he's a bad one. There's something about that guy. You don't cast Harry Hamlin, you don't cast a big name, big heavy hitter like Hamlin in this, and have him just, you know, push some pencils around. Lo and behold, second episode turned out to be a wrong'un.
Can I also say, by the way, because I'm not sure I talked about it last week, Derry Girls on Channel 4.
Oh,
if you're
my
not
God,
watching
so good.
Derry Girls.
What is it?
Get after
it.
I've never heard of it.
It's a comedy, James. You wouldn't like it. And it's got strange accents.
It's a half-hour comedy set in Derry in the 90s.
It's set in Londonderry, Helen. You're absolutely
you're right.
It
is, exactly. You're in Derry.
Right. And, it is set, indeed, in Londonderry.
Or, Helen, as we say, Derry. Anyway.
Helen is absolutely right. Once again.
Stop this sectarian violence immediately.
And it is, it's about Northern Irish teenagers. And
that's right. It is about Northern Irish teenagers in Londonderry.
You're quite right. Look, they're from my side of the tracks. All right. Stop. My point being,
respect the Good Friday Agreement.
Thanks, James.
I've got nothing but respect for the Good Friday Agreement. It's the Great Friday Agreement, if you ask me.
Oh, good Lord. So anyway, it's phenomenal and it's very, very funny, and I have never cackled so much watching
it's
TV.
It's so good.
I will admit, you may need like a glossary or something, because it does use, you know, Northern Irish terms and
right.
expressions.
He's going to need subtitles.
Actually, just switch on the subtitles.
I'm going to give this a miss. It's already a comedy, half hour, and I need subtitles. It's just
honestly, it's phenomenally funny.
Well, the thing is, I'd say I'm far too busy, but I actually ended up watching, as I was tweeting, I watched the series finale of ER for no apparent reason last week, because I'd never watched the last few series, and I thought, you know what, I'll watch the final episode. A lot happened in the episodes I missed. It was a whole thing.
Dr. Green left before the end, though, so why would
left,
you keep watching?
Left is a euphemism for what happened to Dr. Green.
Oh, yeah, I've just remembered.
Didn't he get a brain tumour?
Yeah, I'm not okay
and
with
that. And then him. Angela Bassett was in it, and apparently Carter married Tandy Newton and had a baby. Missed that. Lots of stuff, things, and what's-her-face. Rory Gilmore was in it as a doctor.
Yeah.
Didn't know that was happening.
Okay, so, right, that's all movie news sorted out then. Our next guest this week... Our final guest this week, rather, is a writer, director, playwright, and he likes to push the envelope, just like his brother, John Michael. He is, of course, Martin McDonagh, the brilliant mind behind In Bruges and Seven Psychopaths. He's back this week with the caustic and thought-provoking Three Billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri. I went to speak to him late last year. Word to the wise, when I turned up for this interview, I realized shortly before going into the room that I had forgotten the microphones. Oh. So, Jimbo, you were there, weren't you?
I was,
the moment, wasn't it?
It was. And I had to sit in the waiting room while we figured out how we were going to do it.
Because the idea was you were going to come in and do it with me. And then realized, oh shit, I've actually left the microphones on my desk at work. So I had to improvise. So the sound levels may not be quite up to scratch. They're hopefully going to be very good in him, less so in me. Which case, win-win. So here you are, Martin McDonagh talking to some idiot. Enjoy.
Delighted to be joined on the Emperor Podcast by the writer and director of the brilliant Three Billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri, Martin McDonagh. How are you, sir?
Good, thanks for having me.
Good. So far, is that a question you've been asked before? How are you?
No, that was good. I like that, yeah.
Okay. We should explain that Martin says, even though you were 3 hours into your press tour, you've already been asked the same question over and over.
A lot of repetition, so if I hear it again, there's going to be a...
That is tough for me because I'm an incredibly generic person. My questions are usually first place. I did want to start off by talking about this, which is the published screenplay of the film, obviously, because I don't see this happen this often these days. I mean, I was having a conversation with another film director the other day. We were talking about Quentin Tarantino and Reservoir Dogs and how the whole cult of a published screenplay seemed to happen around that time.
Yeah, I remember getting them at that time too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it seems to have gone away. So is this something that you are trying to bring back? How does this come about?
I like it. Maybe it's the background in theatre and having a relationship with Faber from the plays. Mm-hmm. There's a natural a link there, and they published In Bruges when that came out. So I think for me, maybe it's about that. But I guess you don't see them around too often. But it's probably just the theatre connection.
It's interesting as well because obviously this movie is now out in the UK until January. So people can now go in and they can buy it and they can be equipped with the text before they go in to see your film.
Oh, I hope they don't though.
But that's the thing. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
That's a bad thing. that was stupid planning on my part. No, they said they wanted them out for the London Film Festival screening, but that was really stupid. But I don't know how many people would read. What do you think? Would they read the screenplay before seeing it?
There's a spoiler culture, and people love to know spoilers.
But which is crazier because I hate them. I hate watching trailers just in case.
You're trailer averse.
I'll start watching a trailer, but if anything starts coming up, I'll switch off. I try to avoid that stuff. But even especially reviews, I never read reviews. You know, I'll glance at the star rating, but I'll never because you don't want to. I don't want to know.
Okay.
I can't imagine why anyone would, especially a film like this, which does have lots of sort of twists and hopefully thing, you know, things you can't see coming at all. I wouldn't want to know because that's part of the storytelling of it.
So after this, you're going to go to Foyles and take them all off shelves,
or just scribble out the parts with the twists.
Just rip out the last 20, 30 pages, something like that,
and some of the middle pages,
and some of the and indeed some of the opening as well.
There you go. So just steal the book.
I remember.
I wonder if they'd jail you for stealing your own books.
No, you'd be fine.
You reckon?
Author's privilege.
There you go.
Yeah, it's a legal thing. And, so you want people to go into this film as blind as you possibly can.
As blind as a bat.
Are you involved in terms of crafting the marketing of the movie? Because
yes. It usually works that they being sort of Fox Searchlight and Film 4, send like a few of like maybe 10 or 12 possible posters.
Okay.
And you give input, and if there's something you like, you kind of you focus on that one and gear them into making that the best version of that as you can. Mm-hmm. And the poster we've got now and the cover of the book is I love it. It was like because it doesn't give too much away. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't display it doesn't beg you to come see it by showing all of the actors in massive photos from 20 years ago. But it kind of hopefully pulls you in with its slightly creepiness, and it's. But there's a classic look to the poster and the cover of the book too. That's kind of, that could be from the 50s or something. Oh, and you could say the film could be the same.
So far, I haven't had a so I think I'm doing okay.
Doing well here.
I'm about to venture into territory.
Uh oh.
Because obviously it's Ebbing, Missouri. Why Ebbing, Missouri? And was that something that?
Ebbing is a made-up town, but I like the sound of the word, and it could be a town in any of the states, really. Mm-hmm. And Missouri, at the time of writing, especially, was just a three syllable state. I knew it was as stupid as that sounds. I liked the sound of it, but it also needed to be one of the old 13 Confederate states, because there's details of sort of police racism in the background of the story, and it's a sort of a Southern Gothic tale to some degree. So it had to be one of those old Southern states, but not one that everything is set in or that everything is filmed in. So you wouldn't want to be in Louisiana or even Georgia. There's an awful lot of stuff filmed there. So somewhere a little off the beaten track that had three syllables.
Rhythm is clearly important to you as a writer and as a director.
Yeah.
And you're working with the actors on this movie that you've worked with before.
Yeah.
So clearly the likes of Sam Rockwell, Woody Harrelson have dialed into your rhythms as a director.
Yeah.
Working with them a second time around, what was new for you as a director with those guys as actors?
It was kind of just almost an easier way of working, even less to talk about on the morning of the shoot. We do know each other's rhythms. You kind of talk about the script and the characters with them before you start shooting, if you can grab like a week or two of rehearsal.
Yeah, yeah.
But a rehearsal can just mean talking about the script with one actor for me. So like on the date, there's not an awful lot of conversations about which way a scene is going to go, because you know that already, and you hopefully sort of know where the character's coming from those old conversations. So it's more about letting them get at it, giving them a bunch of goes, and just trying to pull out if you think there's a couple of lines should be sadder or angrier or funnier. Just aim for repeating those a little bit more. But with actors of that caliber, it's there's a lot that goes unsaid.
I mean, as a writer, though, are you thinking of the rhythm of the title is clearly important to you? But I presume you don't start with the title. I presume you start with an idea, a plot idea, or do you start with a thematic idea?
Never the thematical.
Never the thematical, because it doesn't exist.
It does now.
Well, why not? We can coin new words.
Exactly. And with me, usually it's not even plot. It's character, or it's an initial little premise. And the initial premise of this was a mother putting up three provocative billboards to call out the local police department for either their ineptitude of not solving her daughter's murder. Mm-hmm. So that was the starting point, but that's not really a plot. But that's all I had. That's all I had to go on.
Does that pop into your head unbidden?
No, that weirdly, that one, I did see something on billboards very similar to this, to what we see in the film, about like 17 or 18 years ago on a bus going through. It could have been Georgia. I'm not sure where the bus was. It could have been Georgia, but I know the trajectory was sort of Georgia, Florida, Alabama, Mississippi. And it was like something you saw in a field in the blink of an eye, literally. But it stayed with me in the idea of what kind of pain or rage would prompt someone to put up a couple of billboards like that, because it was just two, I think. It just stayed with me. And once I decided it was a mother who'd done it, it was almost like the part of Mildred, played by Frances, it just almost started writing itself. Yes. To have someone starting from a place of rage and anger like that, and also the willpower to put something up there, just gave me an insight into the mind of this strong, fierce, determined woman. And they're kind of unusual in films. So there was something kind of joyful about following what the hell she would do from scene to scene. And I didn't know what it would be. So that's kind of how this one got written. I was just following her and seeing what she would do next. And then you kind of set up the opposite number to her, which is Woody's character, Willoughby, the chief of police that she's calling out. And then, you know, you surround him with his underlings, I guess. And one of those would be Sam Rockwell, who's a bit more thuggish and a bit more racist than one would like a police officer to be. So, but the thing is, like, and the idea that started revealing itself was that the war is between Francis's character and Woody's character, but they're both not bad people. So it's like a war between two sides who are in the right to a large extent. And what happens when a war like that escalates? And that's kind of pretty early on where the story started pointing to.
So you say that you don't really know where the story's going to go. You don't really know where the characters are going to go. Presumably, obviously, you want to surprise the audience, and you, by surprising yourself, that's half the job done.
Yeah.
As you're writing a scene, you obviously know where the scene's beginning. Do you know where it's going to end? How far in advance do you know what's going to happen to characters?
Maybe only like a scene or two ahead of the scene that's about to be the shocker, you know. So that I think came as much of a surprise to me as hopefully it will to an audience who hasn't checked all the spoilers or read the book.
Read the screenplay. So is there a moment when you're doing something like that and a character will surprise you or a development will surprise you and you stop and you take stock and you go, okay, this is going in a completely different direction from what I anticipated?
How does that affect everything?
It hasn't affected anything. Or is it too far and I have to back up and wipe that out?
But you do that. But you are like, at this stage of my writing career or whatever you'd call it, I usually only go like two or three scenes down a dead end to know before I know it is a dead end it's closing off too many options. I think when you're writing, certainly, like in the first 20 or 30 pages, everything should be on the table and everything should be opening out. But as you get to the middle, you should be sort of rounding the bend for home, I think. You can't keep bringing new revelations in. You should be... So all the revelations and the surprises should really be coming in the first half hour, maybe, or longer. The structure of this, I don't know what the hell it is, you know, because it seems to work, you couldn't tell me what the structure is. I think the first act is an act, but then there's nothing.
No, true.
It's just like characters.
It's not like you even have like the three billboard, three act structure where it's one billboard per act. It's not quite as signposted, signposted as that.
Yeah, but somehow, and I guess I was trying to think about it earlier today, I think because the character arcs, if you, I kind of hate that phrase, but if that is real and truthful, somehow that kids us into thinking that there is a structure to it, and there really isn't. But because those arcs are different, I think you go with it. And so far, audiences have, because that's the payoff, almost more than the plot being a payoff.
You mentioned that Faber have also published in Bruges. Was Seven Psychopaths something you considered publishing, or
I don't think. I think we all kind of lost our. I think for me it didn't quite work, and no one was knocking down my door to print it. So I think we kind of agreed to let that one slip by. I would have, but they didn't care about it. And
that's interesting. So is it a movie that you feel perhaps less than fondly towards? I think it, last time I spoke to you was actually on stage for
yes,
a Q&A.
Yeah, it's my least favourite of the three. I think I really liked what we achieved with Bruges, and I wasn't so happy. And it was all my fault. The looking at it from a distance, the reason I don't like it are my problems alone,
okay,
or my faults in the directing of it. I think it's tricky to do something that's that meta and that it's almost a film about films instead of being a film about real characters. And I didn't want that to happen with this one. I didn't want it to be a movie about movies, because in Bruges wasn't. It was like, even though it's like a genre sort of story, or had the facade of a genre story, it was just about a couple of blokes in a tragic situation, really.
Yes, of
course. And so I kind of watched them back to back before making this one, and tried to pick out what it was that I did like about the first that I didn't like about the second, and try to give more room for the good stuff in this one. And that was mostly about just letting characters breathe, letting them, seeing them think on screen, seeing them look at themselves in a mirror even, but just giving them time to be with them, just to fill in their thoughts almost, to just linger on their eyes at the end of a scene and just wonder what they're going through.
Interesting. Frances is amazing in this film.
Yeah, she's brilliant.
If she doesn't get nominated, there's something deeply, deeply wrong with the universe. But yeah.
And win, I say.
And win.
But I think Sam too. I mean, Sam's never been nominated, and he's never been nominated for an Oscar. And I think it's a crime. It would be a crime if he doesn't. But it was a crime that he didn't get nominated for Moon. You know, all Confessions, but Moon especially, because that's two performances or more in one movie.
Absolutely, you are very right.
He should have got nominated for two Oscars.
Hell, he should be nominated for being Sam Rockwell.
Exactly,
Being Sam Rockwell. I'd nominate for Iron Man 2 personally, but that's just me. But they are phenomenal in this movie, and I remember speaking to Peter Mullen a few years ago, and he was talking about first day as an actor. You want something simple. You want that opening the door scene. You want to feel your way into a character. I imagine, though, an actress like Frances, an actor like Sam, and Woody even, that they come day one and they show up right away. Or do they ease into it? Can you remember?
They do show up, ready to go. But you still don't want to jump into to the toughest scenes in the first week, even let alone the first day. Definitely, the first day you want it to be as easy a day as possible. Because they haven't had time to get into the character really yet.
Yeah.
As much prep as you might do, there's no, I think they seem to learn it as they go along during the filming. So no, even in the first week, you want to keep it simple. It's those probably third and fourth weeks are always the heart of the film.
They're the ones you build towards.
Yeah, if it's like a 7-week shoot, it's like weeks three and four that is usually the big stuff. You've got to give them, and you as a director too. I mean, like, I leave big gaps between making films, and sometimes it feels like you're really starting from scratch when you do a new one. It was a little bit less so this way, but it's always you're around a lot of new people, and you might have lost a bit of confidence, or you don't you know, it's just new stuff. But at the same time, that's why kind of I've started almost using a repertory company of actors, because yeah. there's about six or seven actors from this who were either in Seven Psychos or Bruges before. So, and also the same DP and the same first AD, and that little triangle with the director is really important, and those are the same as on Seven Psychos.
The last thing I'm going to ask is this is, you're not going to go at this one, that's for sure.
I am, whatever it is.
No, you're not. I'm telling you, you're not. So a few years ago, Empire took part in a charity football tournament down at the Den in Millwall.
Uh-oh.
And I seem to recall seeing you, and I think John was there as well.
Yeah.
Your brother John.
Yeah.
So were you... I was playing.
Who were you with?
We were the Empire team that finished bottom of our group.
Oh yeah. You were the San Marino of the group.
Pretty
remember.
Much, yeah. We're the bye.
Without the style.
So I just wanted to, were you there just to support people, or are you a football fan?
No, we just love playing football, and okay. we're really loud and really not very good. But we would think about that charity tournament all year, and right. I think it's defunct now. I don't think they've played it the last couple of years. But we were going up until 2 years ago.
Like, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Ask us back.
Yeah, the Whipping Boys never really come back. But we only ever got to the semis. But we got there twice, I think.
Okay.
But yeah, I'd play with, like, I know a bunch of Irish actors from the plays mostly, who were really quite good footballers too.
All right, okay.
And they all, David Wilmot was one of them, Barry Ward, who has done the Ken Loach film recently. Really good, proper footballers. So it'd be, I miss it.
Brilliant. Martin, what a pleasure. Thank
Cheers.
You so much.
That's lovely.
Thank you. That's
great.
Thank you. But not a single they're right.
Yeah, no, and it literally wasn't a repeated question.
There we go.
Okay, so that was Martin McDonagh. Let's get on to the reviews now. And should we start with Martin McDonagh's film, the Golden Globe winning Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, a.k.a. what is it? The Billboards of Wrath?
The Billboards of Wrath.
The Billboards of Rage. Yeah. Raging Billboards. which is what it should be called. And this is, for me, a phenomenal study of grief and loss and revenge and morality. Yeah, it's very, very, very.
It's also very funny in a very dark way.
Yeah.
Like, as in the dialogue absolutely sizzled. Mm. And after watching this, I was like, no one can deliver an expletive quite like Frances McDormand. Some of the swearing in this is extraordinary.
There's also a line involving a person called Penelope delivered by Peter Dinklage that is my favourite line reading maybe ever. It is absolutely a thing of beauty.
He's fantastic in it as well. It's really, really good. It's touching, it's heartbreaking, it's devastating, it's grueling, it's funny. I mean, it's kind of everything. I have very few bad things to say about this film, actually. In fact, it's almost certainly going to be in my top five of this year, even though we saw it last year. Frankly, if you haven't already gone and seen it, you're an idiot. Go and see it immediately.
I mean, it literally hasn't come out yet.
It's hardly an excuse,
this.
Helen.
Just to summarise the plot for a moment, Frances McDormand plays a grieving mother who has lost her daughter in violent, horrific circumstances. And she rents these three billboards outside the town of Ebbing, Missouri, where she lives, to publicise the fact that there have been no arrests made and no significant progress with the investigation into the killing whatsoever. And this is to sort of spur the local police chief, who's played by Woody Harrelson, into some kind of action and get him to do something. This obviously shakes things up that perhaps she might wish that had not been shaken up, or at least she doesn't mind, but other people wish had not been shaken up, causes him some amount of grief. His deputy, Sam Rockwell, played by Sam Rockwell, who is a guy on the edge, trigger-tempered, extremely bad impulse control.
A big old racist.
And a big old racist, deals with it extremely badly indeed, and things fall from there.
He is extraordinary in it.
He really is. And I would say Woody Harrelson as well.
Actually. I was about to say, yeah, I think it's a beautifully understated role from him. He plays it so softly and so well.
Yeah.
Weirdly, I quite enjoyed Caleb Landry-Jones in this, and I rarely do. But I thought it's a relatively small role, but I think he plays that very well. Yeah. Yeah, really good film. Can't recommend it enough.
I did have a few issues with it. Yeah. People have pointed out that it's not a good film on race, and I think that's fair.
Yeah, Mark Bernardin wrote a really interesting piece this week. He's the co-host of Fat Man on Batman with Kevin Smith. Really interesting writer. Yeah. He wrote a piece in The Guardian this week. He's African-American, Mark, and he wrote a piece about how he had issues with the film's treatment of race in the movie.
And there's a redemption arc that I would argue is quite controversial. But
yeah,
it could have been dealt with much better by trying not to be so hot button.
I can see why people might have an issue with this movie, but it is really well acted.
Yeah, I mean, McDonough's phenomenal. Yeah. Phenomenal.
Really well written. It is often funny, very, very funny, but it is also extraordinarily dark, but not as heavy as it sounds. So 5 stars for 3 billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri. Okay, let's move on then to Darkest Hour, the Joe Wright, Gary Oldman show, Winston Churchill's finest hour.
I think that's probably fair. This was this is an interesting companion piece actually to Dunkirk, because this is essentially what was happening on the other side of the Atlantic while Ken Branagh and co. were on the beaches. This was literally Winston Churchill's pretty much his first week in office. So he became prime minister, something he'd worked for and wanted his entire life, really, or certainly his entire political career, at a moment when almost the entire British army faced apparently certain defeat at the hands of the advancing Nazis who were coming through France at the time. And their backs were to the sea. They couldn't get the ships to them. They certainly couldn't get them fast enough to evacuate something like 300,000 men trapped on the beaches. And the entire British ruling class, pretty much, wanted to sue for peace. And Winston Churchill was almost alone in saying, well, you've seen it in the trailer. If you've seen the trailer, you cannot negotiate with a tiger when your head is in his mouth. That is essentially the setup. You've got a guy who's thrown into the toughest job in the world at the toughest time for that job ever. And obviously comes out of it smelling like, well, cigars and champagne, because I can't imagine he ever smelled of anything else. But came out of it much better than one had any reason to expect.
And this is Churchill's darkest hour, but also his finest hour in many ways. Is it an interesting counterpoint to Churchill, which obviously casts him in a slightly less triumphant light?
Yes, it is. Well, that's sort of the end of the war and him coming to sort of the end of his necessity, I guess.
Yeah, this is all Operation Overlord, isn't it, Churchill?
Yeah, Overlord and Churchill. It's interesting. I mean, there's a couple of things about this film that I had an issue with. This is the third time we've been introduced to Churchill in the last 12 months or so via the medium of a new secretary coming in and him bullying her. And I feel like that's not something that we should have seen 3 times. That seems like overkill. He actually had one secretary for most of his time in office, so it's bad in that sense. But just like, there's got to be another way. And this film at least must have had time to see at least one of the others, and should have maybe rethought that, I would have thought. Having said that, this is Gary Oldman in, as somebody described it today, God mode. Like, this is a fantastic performance from Gary Oldman. Unrecognisable, brilliant, brilliant, and very convincing and very natural prosthetics. Literally pillow down his jumper, I assume. But he is, you know, he's really, really impressive as Churchill. You've got the likes of Kristen Scott Thomas and basically the cream of Britain's character actors around him. Mm-hmm. So phenomenal performances all round. I mean, it's odd timing for this film. It's odd to have had 2 films about essentially Dunkirk this year. And I'm not sure that says things I personally am very comfortable with about where this country's at the moment. But it is a very, very good telling of a very, you know, a great time for this guy and a time of greatness for him.
Are we saying Oldman over Cox and Lithgow?
Yeah, yeah, easily. I mean, Lithgow was great, but and Cox actually, I mean, he's very good. You're not going to usually bet against Brian Cox, but this is a whole other level.
What about Christian Slater?
Churchill, the War Years, I have actually watched years ago, and it was not as funny as that should have been. So
that's an understatement.
Whereas this is exactly as funny as it should have been.
All right, okay. And really interestingly directed by Joe Wright as well. Lots of...
Yeah.
Because it's not the boring old fuddy-duddy chamber piece that it could have been.
No, I think he does his best to try and get Churchill out and about as much as possible. There is one scene which I don't think works for that. It's an underground scene, which you'll know as soon as you see it, and you're like, chinny reckon. But otherwise, I think he tries to show, and he was a guy who moved around a lot, who was very active, even though he had a nap every afternoon. He you know, he did a lot, he went and saw a lot, he didn't like to be just locked up in an office. And this kind of gets a little bit of that across. And there's a little bit of the action, obviously, of Dunkirk and of Dover nearby, or sorry, of Calais nearby. So you get out and about a little bit. But yeah, it's a lot of parliamentary speeches as well, but the good ones. So it's okay. 4 stars.
4 stars. 4 stars in for Darkest Hour. That's a cracking week. It's a good time, isn't it? We're getting a lot of good films. Three Billboards and Darkest Hour. 9 stars between them. That's 4.5 each rounded up. They're both 5 stars.
Amazing. Wait, no, what? That's not how we do it.
That's how we do it.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure that's how we do it. And hey, someone wrote in saying that we hadn't reviewed Pitch Perfect 3.
I have.
No, but on the podcast.
Oh, that's true.
We hadn't really mentioned Pitch Perfect 3. So let's mention Pitch Perfect 3.
Yeah.
It's fine. You gave it 2.
I give it 2. I mean, you know, I felt it was like a high 2 or a low 3, but it's more of a high 2 for me.
Acatedious.
Not acatedious, just acalazy, really.
No, it just feels like it's grasping for something it hasn't done before while trying to do all the things it's done before as well, and that didn't entirely work for me. There's just a couple of subplots that I thought were ridiculous and too far and too much. And, you know, the music was good. So I still like the music.
Music's fine. Made me laugh enough to forgive it all its little foibles, because it's a very, very lazy film. I mean, there's a kernel of a good idea in there for what it could have been, where you have the Elizabeth Banks and John Michael Higgins characters following the Bellas around the world trying to shoot a documentary. And it's just like, guys, that's the film. That's the film. Whether it's a faux documentary or whatever.
This is going to be the last one now, essentially. Yeah, this is in many ways.
Well, they all die.
The Bellas end.
No, this. Oh, dear.
I nearly trod on your amazing joke. I'm so sorry. Bellas end. Oh, my
good
God.
Lord.
I apologize.
But no, it actually is the end of a trilogy. It feels like the end of a trilogy. So I don't expect to see more of them. But it's just, it's about, they're trying to sell 3 or 4 different stories at once, and I didn't think it worked.
I didn't enjoy the second one, if I'm honest with you. I think they never really recaptured the charm of the original.
Yeah, and I think that's something they do here. So 2 stars in for Pitch Perfect 3, which
Frito.
So if you do fancy going to see it, I thought I would probably have given it a low 3, because it entertained me enough.
Yeah.
But also, so there we go. Pitch Perfect 3. And that means that's it. We're done. We're done for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by Lee Unkrich, director of Pixar's latest Coco.
Hooray.
Until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from James.
Bye.
And it's goodbye from me. You know what I'm going to do, guys? I'm going to go to the first post and have a lovely drink. And maybe after that, I'll go to the old familiar. And maybe after that, pop into the famous cock. Then maybe I might sneak in for a sneaky one at the Cross Hands, followed by, of course, a quick drink at the Good Companions. Maybe followed up with a trusty servant. Let's see how I'm feeling. Go the two-headed dog, then the mermaid, then the beehive, stagger along to the King's Head, pop into the hole in the wall, and then round the whole thing off at the end of the world. The world's end.
Chris.
Damn it.
You don't even drink. And if you have that many Coke Zeros, you'll be sick.
She's not wrong.
This is true. But what if I have some Britvic? I'll be bouncing off the walls. Bouncing off the bloody walls.
Go up to the barman and say I'll have a pint of the black stuff. Can't go wrong.
All right. Thank you so much for listening. See you next week. Bye.